Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome again on Circles of Change, and it's always a pleasure to include a guest that helps us step into my one mantra that says focus on the F's to get an A in transition, and that being your faith, your family, your food, your fitness, your wellness, and your focus on others. So with that, Dr. Stephen Cusine in New York. How are you today, Stephen?
Good morning. Fine. Thank you. How are you, Sarah?
Terrific. Well, we've got a lot in the change space here, both on Dr. Cusine's own personal experience as well as the mission of his business at this point in time. So let me give a brief intro. He's a native of New York and attended Columbia University, then medical and postgraduate school at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. His hospital experience started in one of the toughest areas of New York City at the Jacob B. Hospital in the Bronx. Certified in internal medicine and joining the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center for a fellowship in gastroenterology, Dr. Cusine then served in Manhattan as assistant professor of clinical medicine at Columbia, where, as he said, the dichotomy between a roiling public city hospital and a world-class private specialty institution gave him a front-row seat in the full theater of medicine. He's a proud father of two sons with his lifetime partner, Annie, and Stephen went on his own to found a solo practice in more rural Utica, New York, that expanded over time to include several physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. A traumatic car accident, though, ended his clinical career in 2005, sparking, though, his passion for patient advocacy, and that's where we're going today. He started a shared decision center to allow people to arrive at unbiased medical decisions based on the evidence and their own goals and priorities. In addition to, frankly, lifetime publishing in professional and academic journals over the years, we're happy today to talk to him about the book that he wrote and just recently released called Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now, Gaining the Upper Hand in Your Medical Care. For those of you streaming right now, bring up his site, medicaladvocate.com. Well, what an interesting play on words. Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now. Terrific.
Yep, that's the idea. Stand conventional wisdom on its head. Patients should know that they're the center of the activity, not the doctor.
Yeah, so you're writing the book now. Is it indeed to complement this advocacy center that you had already started?
The book stimulated the shared decision center.
Okay.
I was a clinician, had the accident, was out of clinical medicine, and it was the accident that stimulated my thoughts and the reflection on what I'd been through, what I'd experienced, what I'd seen, and how other patients were being treated. And so I learned from it, I reflected upon it, and it prompted an action I never previously anticipated, which was writing this book. And that led to the second career as an author, and now a third career as an advocate. It's the embodiment of your circles of change, Dr. Laura.
Yeah, and you're right on, Stephen. Isn't that true? And individuals should know that this is not a 50 or 100 or 200-page self-published book, by the way. I have it in front of me. It's 270 pages with notes and lists of websites and a tremendously rich resource, as well as written in a style that certainly reflects all your lifetime of academic training and clinician work. So congratulations.
Well, thanks. It wasn't fun. It certainly was educational for me.
Well, and in fact, usually when I talk to authors, it's one thing to write the book and, in other words, go through, I know a female metaphor, the pregnancy. But now that the baby's been born, to see in what direction it might start to pull you. Are you feeling that pull yet, even though it's been just recently released?
Oh, yes. It was bought up by the publishing company a year ago, and it was a speculative endeavor for years.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I sold it to Roman and Littlefield, it was a huge moment, but there was a year between getting a contract and editing it and then promoting it and then having it come out. So it was a very pregnant year indeed, as you mentioned.
Great. Well,
I decided to open up a shared decision center.
Wonderful. Just wonderful. So upon reflection and the journey you've been on, you know, what was it like really for you, the doctor, to become the patient and the kind of major learnings that struck you in the course of your own journey, Stephen?
And that's the question, and I thank you for it, because in reality, I have no idea what it's like to be a patient in the traditional sense. Mm-hmm. And that's what stimulated me to think about writing the book. My opinions were respected. My privacy and my dignity were maintained. I knew my physicians. I knew their lives, their wives, their spouses, their strengths, their weaknesses. I fired one right on the spot. And so in many ways, when I reflected on the way I was treated and I saw the way other patients were being treated, I realized that the disparity
right.
was so huge that there were perhaps lessons to learn based on my experience both as a patient and as a clinician. So that the key message of the book is you don't have to be a but it requires some work and some skills that patients need to master.
And I don't think that anybody ever teaches us how to do the patient thing, or as you even write in your book, the word patienthood.
It's something that rises above a specific illness or a problem. It's a transcendent approach toward being in front of a physician and a view of your own health. People are such wonderful retail consumers, but such terrible healthcare consumers. We'll spend more time researching our next vacation than we do our next surgery. You could look at flat screen TV and pay people. Will look at magazines, they'll discuss it with neighbors, they'll know the circuitry, and yet they'll treat doctors as if they're a homogeneous group of smart people. They'll look at hospitals and not realize each hospital is its own individual brand. So it's really quite stunning. People will come to a doctor with a Google search and don't understand why doctors dismiss them.
And why would that? You know, and tell us a bit about that, because I know that's one area of your book. You richly present alternative websites or information sources for people to rely upon.
There is out there, and they're not hard to find. And once they're found, they're not difficult to read. I try to teach in the book how to read medical articles. Industrial strength, physician grade articles and information. Because when you bring that data to a physician, instead of saying, I did a Google search or I saw on this commercial website, instead, you approach the physician and said, I just saw in the Archives of Internal Medicine mm-hmm. last month
yeah.
an article about my diabetes pill. You'll learn two things. Number one, if your physician is up to date. If they're not up to date, are they willing to get up to date and get back to you? Or are you going to be dismissed even when you're bringing in valid, important information that reflects your goals and your priorities? And in just that one activity, you can assess your doctor pretty effectively.
You know, I think it's all too easy. It's all too easy, is it not, sometimes to walk into the doctor's office and be swept off your feet to see the certifications that are nicely framed and posted on the wall. And I know one thing I always think is, do I look at the dates on those and what's been the continuing education that the doctor has been engaged in, or even contribution in his field, like you have, continuing to be published and so on, that he or she stays current?
Board certification is something that people look to as a validating attribute. It really isn't, because this is a test that when taken, the vast majority of people who are board certified pass the test. And so it only teaches you, if you don't have board certification, to stay a long distance away, because those are very few physicians who are not board certified. And those are people who either were never qualified to take the boards or failed them probably multiple times. But simply having the boards is not enough. What you'd really like to know is the score of the boards. You'll never get that.
Right, right.
That's really what tells you what your doctor's all about. Their IQ, their board scores, their income. These are the unattainable ways of assessing your physician. So we have to find different ways to learn if your physician is smart. Board certification is necessary, but it's by no means sufficient.
You know, one of the challenges I have felt recently, and I know others would echo this, is that you go into the doctor's office and you feel it's all too quick that you're going to be prescribed a drug to take care of something. and not just even having the time. I mean, you made the choice to go and start your own practice, and from the introduction, of course, I mentioned that you've surrounded yourself with a variety of practitioners and physician's assistants and so on. Is that not one of our biggest challenges, is just getting the management of time with these experts to talk us through the issues?
Yes, and I'm afraid that there's no solution to it. And instead of getting more time with doctors, I think your listeners are going to understand that they're going to be getting far less time as time goes on. There's a projected physician shortage of up to 40 to 50,000 physicians in the next 10 years. Physicians are becoming increasingly employed by hospitals. And with the new healthcare law, 40 million more Americans, quite happily, are going to be insured. So the demand will be huge, the supply dropping, and the distance between the doctor and patient ever widening. And so that, again, puts on the individual consumer the need to be involved, to be engaged, to be aware, and to be as avid a consumer of medical care as they are of retail.
So the organization you started, a shared decision center, what does that mean? Describe what that is to our listeners.
In the United States, it's something new. In Canada and Europe, it's been around for a long time, and I think it's the solution for the 12-minute visit. When you walk out of a doctor's office with an opinion with a condition that's going to last a lifetime or threaten your lifeline, you're simply in that 12 to 15-minute visit not going to have the opportunity to learn enough. You may walk out of an office with the truth, but it's a version of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
In medicine, there's a spectrum that goes from the safest, the most time-honored, the most inexpensive, the lowest need for high technology, and then proceeds along a spectrum that ends with the experimental, the high-tech, unproven, often unnecessary. And patients have to get within that body of knowledge to learn where the controversies live. That's not going to happen in 12 minutes in a doctor's office.
So the idea is...
It can happen at the shared decision center, where patients can see the spectrum, the evidence, unbiased, not profit-driven, and as importantly, contribute their own priorities. What might be good for you, Dr. Larson, may not be good for me.
That's right.
What might be good for you today, Dr. Larson, may not be good for you 3 years from now when you're faced with another similar decision. Priorities, goals, risk tolerance, risk aversion, trade-offs, they're all part of every medical decision, but they're key when these decisions affect your welfare and affect your future. And that's what a shared decision center does.
You bet. We're speaking with Dr. Kevin Cousine. His new book, Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now, Gaining the Upper Hand in Your Medical Care. His website, and by the way, is medicaladvocate.com. You dedicate a certain portion of the book, Dr. Cousine, to the hospitals themselves. You know, of course, that changing dynamic, the landscape. Give us a sense of what you feel some of the positive changes are underway, but still how it's lagging, and remind us we still need to be in charge.
10 years ago, the Institute of Medicine issued a landmark paper called To Err is Human, and it outlined all the difficulties that face patients when they enter a hospital. And it stirred a great amount of interest and a great amount of shock in the public, in the medical field, and in industry itself. Medical errors, medication errors, hospital-acquired infections, psychological trauma, the unproven, the unnecessary. And in the ensuing 10 years, what has been shown is so little has changed. Some states have been very proactive. Individual hospital and healthcare systems have been proactive. But the lack of change is so stunning in the light of the uproar that this paper produced that it again reflects the fact that when you're in the hospital, and there's a fellow named Peter Pronovost who's a rock star amongst physicians, he said, and I quote him, when you're in the ICU, you are, quote, utterly on your own, which is a horrible thing to contemplate, but it's true. So the culture of safety, the culture for change, mm-hmm. you would think would be so prominent in the minds of those who administer hospitals and administer healthcare in this country. And it may change in time, but it hasn't changed yet. And again, the onus is on the individual.
So it would be the individual, and of course, if they're not in full capacity because of their illness, their loved ones or who are helping marshal them through this system then. So it's really the entire family education process that has to happen, not just the individual.
Absolutely. In the hospital, you are never so in need of what I call designated sitters who are with you round the clock, who by whose presence alone the staff is put on some sort of awareness that this is a different patient, this is a different kind of family. It doesn't require being confrontational, but everyone should be sitting there with a laptop connected to the hospital's wireless and have on that laptop programs that are available, inexpensive, many are free, that allow them to research every opinion, every drug, every interaction that's possible, and be able to question it with some degree of skepticism, but with an honest gee whiz, you know, this is happening to me and I have some questions, I'd like some answers.
So the reactions of your book so far from fellow doctors, you know, knowing that now there's a whole different customer value chain they need to be more mindful of, and so how can they engage them in a possible positive way? I mean, you've gone through the experience of sitting on the other side of the stethoscope in a, you know, in a life-threatening situation. Are you finding doctors reading your book right now saying, you know, boy, this could be a roadmap for me to understand how I also need to change?
I think doctors want to change. I don't think they have the space, the resources,
right,
or the time to be able to present to patients the kind of information that should be demanded by them. Some doctors simply don't. There's a profit motive, it's a business, and that's the end of it. But I've been around medicine and practiced for 30 years, and I've never sat in a room with a group of physicians and heard any one of them saying, I'm doing this test, I'm performing this surgery, I'm ordering this x-ray, and boy, it's putting money in my pocket.
No, yeah.
It doesn't exist in our conversations, but it does exist in our psyches. And sometimes it's conscious and sometimes it's not. It's the old expression, when the only tool in your tool belt is a hammer, every solution looks like a nail.
You got it.
And so if you have chest pain and coronary artery disease, if you see a cardiothoracic surgeon, you're going to get a coronary artery bypass. If you see a cardiologist, you're going to get an angioplasty. If you see your family doctor, you're going to get medications. Amongst the three, who's right? They're all right. How can they all be right? Well, you're right too, and that's the level of where we find ourselves in medicine today. There are different approaches, many approaches to the same thing. Some are right for you and some aren't. Some are evidence-based, others aren't. Doctors do what they're trained to do, and they tend to look at patients not so much as individuals, but as diseases, conditions, cases. And they don't have the time, and the system doesn't allow them the time in many cases, to really see you as a human being.
Well, In fact, that would be the opportunity. That would be the opportunity for all of us, is to say how I can explain to my doctors, in fact, my variety of doctors, me as a total system then.
Getting within your doctor's circle of empathy is no easy chore. But it's possible, and I have a chapter devoted to empathy, where empathy went, why your doctors are not empathic, why it went away, how to gain some of it back, so that you can be viewed as someone who the doctor, when they see you, is actually seeing themselves in you. They have to recognize aspects of themselves when they see a patient. Patients should come to an office and they should maybe dress up a little bit. Get on socioeconomic parity. They ought to bring a book. Have you read this book, doctor? Or I just came from a movie. Or by the way, I got a picture of my son. Would be somehow sharing in however brief a moment possible. It's never going to be prolonged. It's never going to be a conversation. But it does kind of change the dynamic in a way that doctors have to experience and patients have to promulgate on their own. The time you're going to be the most sick in your life, you're going to be in the hospital. And what's happening now in the system is, instead of being cared for by the doctor who knows you the best, however minimally on those multiple hundreds of 12-minute visits, you're going to be seen by a stranger who doesn't know you, doesn't know your doctor, who you don't know, whose skills you can't be confident over, and it's a perfect storm for medical error. The hospitalist movement that's occurred in the United States over the last 5 years is something that's very important, a big negative in my opinion, and my book goes into great detail on how to get around this system that further alienates and separates you from your physicians at a time when they have to be the closest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put. Back to this whole idea we talked earlier about, you know, board certifications being incomplete and looking for other indications of, you know, where is your doctor on point of really having a grasp of information. You know, how do you suggest to our listeners some of those key questions they could ask to vet that out?
There are two questions that allow you to assess where your doctor lies in the spectrum between nothing but experience that was taken 20, 30 years ago and being right up to date with the current evidence. And there are two questions, I call them medical shibboleths. If you ask your doctor about where they stand, if you're a man, on the issue of PSAs, and if you're a woman, inquire of your physician how they feel about mammograms, the answers you get, and you have to research them a bit on your own, and the book has all the sites you need in order to really understand what's going on in these two controversial areas. But the answers you get will reflect a lot about the physician who's taking care of you, mm-hmm. their brains, their communication skills, and where they are vis-a-vis being contemporary in the literature. And the simple response to those two questions will tell every patient a lot about the physicians who are taking care of them. For example, PSAs right now are very controversial, and yet one-third of the PSA blood tests that are drawn without the patient even knowing it.
Yeah.
And if it comes back high, you've bought a ticket to a three-ring circus that you never really wanted to be in.
Yeah, exactly right.
And women, the issue of mammograms, especially in the age 40 to 49, but even in the 50s and 60s, there's enough controversy. You want to really have your doctor weigh in on it so a woman who's getting a mammogram understands that in a 10-year period, maybe one or two lives will be saved, but hundreds will have repeat mammograms and biopsies, and many will be subjected to overtreatment because of overdiagnosis. And knowing it going into it doesn't mean men should not have PSAs, and it doesn't mean women should not have mammograms, but they should be aware of what they're signing into. And that, again, has to do with risk tolerance versus risk aversion. What are you willing to risk today, right this minute, for something that you'll probably not get in the next 10 years, but are doing your best to prevent? The best thing to be healthy is not to do screening, although screening may be important for those who want it, but it's prevention. And prevention is a very sad state of affairs today because it basically goes around wellness, exercise, diet, lifestyle issues, and those are very hard to change in contemporary American culture now.
In fact, it even reflects back on our previous guest where we talked about five ways to successfully change a habit and have it be sustainable. Well, Dr. Stephen Cousine, thank you so much for joining us today. His book is Doctor, Your Patient Will See You Now, Gaining the Upper Hand in Your Medical Care. Also, check out his website that is rich with information. That would be medicaladvocate.com. Thanks again. All the best. We'll look forward to watching the journey as this book takes additional impact as it gains the sales, and I'm sure it will. Thank you very much, Dr. Cousine.
Thank you, Dr. Lawrence.
Very good. My pleasure.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.